Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Congressman John Sarbanes. As chair of the Democracy Reform Task Force, Sarbanes confronts conflicts of interest and ethical lapses. You can hear him in conversation with The Ivy's Ed Berlin, Friday, November 3rd at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks. This is Roughly Speaking, episode 318. It's the second day of November 2017. We're talking politics on the show today with Aaron Cox, the Sun's State House Bureau Chief, my colleague from the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, and with Heather Mazier, the progressive Democrat who served in the Maryland House of Delegates, then ran for governor in 2014. She didn't win. But after being pretty much out of politics for a couple of years, Heather Mazier has reemerged and started a new organization with the goal of bridging political divisions, a daunting challenge in the time of Donald Trump. Heather Mazier will join us in about 20 minutes or so to talk about Ms. Maryland, Soul Force Politics. First, we go to the witty and astute Aaron Cox to get a rundown of all those Democratic candidates lining up for the 2018 Maryland primary in the hopes of challenging incumbent Republican Larry Hogan. This might take a while, but I think we should list all the candidates for governor in the Democratic primary in 2018. So let's start now, and then if we still have time to talk, we will have a whole full podcast segment with Aaron Cox.
This feels like a pop quiz. I hope I collect everybody. We have Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker.
Right.
We have Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz.
Right.
We have State Senator Richard Madalino out of Montgomery County. Then we have, those are all the electeds. And then we have Ben Jealous, the former head of the NAACP and a progressive organizer. We have Alec Ross, a tech entrepreneur and author who worked in the Obama administration. Another Obama alum, Krish Vinjaraha. I apologize if I butchered her name. She was a policy director for Michelle Obama. We have Jim Shea, longtime Democratic donor and former chairman of the prominent Baltimore law firm Venable. And last but not least, we have Maya Rocky Moore Cummings, a public policy consultant and coincidentally the wife of Congressman Elijah Cummings.
That's very good, Aaron.
100%.
I was doing a finger count, and I'm not sure I put them all up. It's seven or eight.
It's eight.
That's a lot.
Yes.
Yes. I've been around for a while, as you know, and I'm trying to remember a Democratic primary that had more than four people of consequence. You know, people who actually had done something in the past other than just run for office.
Right.
We used to have some gadfly candidates, perennial candidates, but I can't think of a primary where there's more than maybe four or five.
Right. So there's an interesting dynamic here, right? You have the electeds who are kind of the more traditional sort of do lower level jobs, get some executive experience, know how the state works, put yourself out there to be the state's, you know, top candidate, kind of an up and out sort of strategy. Mm-hmm. And then but then you have these five other candidates who have never held public office in Maryland. And that kind of reflects, you know, what our politics are like right now, I would say, across the country and particularly here in Maryland, where, Bernie Sanders' success, Donald Trump's success, has really highlighted that you don't necessarily have to have been an establishment candidate. You haven't had to work within the party system. You just have to have a message that resonates with people right now. I mean, and you could even look at Larry Hogan's success in 2014. There's another guy who never had held public office.
Yeah, of course, his dad was a congressman, and he worked for Bob Ehrlich when he was governor.
Yes, I mean, and he did, I believe it was Steny Hoyer he tried to unseat once. He had run for office mm-hmm. before, but he really had been, involved in politics, but not an elected official
himself. He was a real estate broker.
Yeah, but he had a message. He had the right message at the right time, and you know, depending on whose forensic analysis of the 2014 election you believe, he either moved a lot of people to jump in his column, or he benefited from headwinds that dramatically depressed Democratic turnout. But either way, you have this kind of outsider candidate with a very populist message, and that's, you know, what a lot of the Democrats in the field 4 years later are now trying to do to unseat him.
It was impressive that Emily's List endorsed Maya Rocky Moore Cummings, who was the latest one to announce that she's running for governor. This is, as you said, the wife of Congressman Elijah Cummings. Now, can you talk a little bit about that? What do you sense from Emily's List's endorsement there?
So first, Emily's List only endorses women. I asked the same question to Emily's List, why Maya Rocky Moore Cummings?
Yeah.
And they said, well, we had two choices. And I said, you didn't consider anyone else? Long silence on the phone.
Yeah.
Emily's List, it might have been a month and a half ago, said they were going to aggressively campaign against Larry Hogan. So even before they picked a candidate, they said, we're going to fight against Larry Hogan. We're going to fund opposition to Larry Hogan. And so they really had two choices. Maya Rocky Moore Cummings, who by virtue of being the wife of a congressman and by virtue of having worked in politics at kind of more of a in the trenches level for a very long time, knows a lot of people. Most political analysts expect her to be able to kind of tap into some of the same networks that help her husband. Not because she, I feel like a woman, I really need to make this clearly, not because she is his wife, but because she is known. This would be, you know, on her own merit.
In political circles.
In political circles, yeah. And
public,
in fundraising circles.
And to the public, she needs to make the case that she's more than just Elijah Cummings' wife. Right.
Right. And anybody who hears her speak, that's immediately clear.
That's what I've
you know, like this isn't 1950 where, you know, she's like, well, you know, I get him a good, you know, a good meal and
right.
You know, keep the house clean. So you should put me in Congress, too. I mean, she's clearly a very sophisticated, well-educated woman who can stand on her own 2 feet.
We've invited her in here for an interview on the podcast. Now, what about the other woman?
The other woman also has a very interesting backstory. She's from Baltimore County. She was brought to the U.S. At 9 months old. Her parents were refugees from Sri Lanka. She went to public schools, went to Yale, went to Oxford, became a lawyer, and worked as a policy director for Michelle Obama. She was helping with some of the initiatives, women in education and some of the healthy eating initiatives, some of the big things that Michelle Obama worked on, that was her claim to fame. She also has a 4-month-old daughter. So she took 3 months off for maternity leave and then launched a campaign for governor. There's a bit of a hiccup with her candidacy. Her residency has been called into question.
Well, she lives in Montgomery County, right?
Yeah, she lives in Montgomery County. She's maintained an address, I believe, in Catonsville, but she also registered to vote and voted in D.C. within the past 5 years. And in Maryland, you have to be a resident for 5 years. And so there's a question about whether or not voting in another state kind of canceled your residency.
And that's not cleared up yet?
No, she's asked a judge to clear it up.
We are speaking of Krishanti Vignarajaj. The last name is Vignarajah, Vignaraja.
Vignaraja, I believe.
Vignaraja, where the J is a soft J. Okay.
I hope so.
Well, that's why we go over these things.
Yes.
I don't assume you see a name and you know how to pronounce it right away.
So. And she also has a brother, Tharoor, who's former deputy attorney general, who
another
was running.
Another impressive person. Yeah.
Yes, who was running for state's attorney against in a primary against Marilyn Mosby.
Here in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So all these people lining up to run against Larry Hogan, and Larry Hogan's popularity seems to be pretty steady. It's not off the charts the way it started out in 2015.
Let's put it this way. He has enviable approval numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
Anybody in politics would look at Larry Hogan's numbers and say, I wish that was me.
Okay. Now, there was this idea that Trump was going to rub off on him, and that Trump was going to hurt a Republican governor in a blue state like Maryland. But that doesn't seem to be happening, and Malia Cromer from the Goucher poll suggests that because he's distanced himself just enough from Trump, that he looks moderate by comparison.
Right. There's also the question, and I'd be curious Malia's answer on this, does that mean that Democrats are eager to vote for him? Right? Because there's two different questions. Do you approve of the job that he's doing? Do you like him personally? And then the second question is, do you think he should get another term, or would you prefer a Democrat?
Right.
And the headwinds for Republicans nationally and in Maryland are not favorable. You know, that there's a lot of people who were disappointed by Trump's election. There is a lot of Democrats who stayed home in 2014 and didn't vote, and they may not think Larry Hogan's done a bad job, but they might be looking at national politics and thinking, you know, we really need a Democrat. You know, they may be looking at, say, you know, the sort of stances that Brian Frosch has taken publicly and been very aggressive denouncing the Trump administration and say, you know, I want more of that. I want a governor like that. And, you know, Democrats in Maryland have the numbers, right? When you talk about how Larry Hogan got elected, he had a coalition of Republicans who turned out very well for him, a lot of independents who voted for him, and some crossover Democrats. But if you look at voter registration in the state, you have about 2 million Democrats, you have about 1 million Republicans, and slightly less than 1 million independents. So if you just get the Democrats to show up and vote for a Democrat, Donald Trump might do that, independent of Larry Hogan.
2018 might pull out more Democrats.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, kind of what the Democratic Party is banking on, and what a lot of these Democratic candidates are saying. I mean, I've heard Ben Jealous say on the campaign trail, he's polling fairly well for a huge, unwieldy field where nobody has high, name recognition. Ben Jealous is holding his own and doing well. He's scooping up a lot of endorsements from labor and progressive groups. And one of the things that he tells voters is, we can't be afraid of being Democrats. We have to show people what Democrats can do. We have to talk about Democratic values, and we shouldn't be ashamed of that, and we should run like Democrats.
I'm glad you mentioned registration, because I'm always curious to see whether the election of a Republican governor means increased Republican registration in Maryland. Is that ever going to grow? I would assume the first place you'd look is independents. Are independents switching over to the Republican Party? I don't see that happening. I thought it might have happened when Bob Ehrlich was governor back then. I can't see it happening now with Trump in the White House and the way they're handling issues in Congress this year.
So right before the election in 2016, I did a story where I pulled historical voter registration data and looked at exactly this question. Are we getting more Democrats? Are we getting more Republicans? Are we getting more independents? And what our data analysis showed is that both parties are losing, and both parties are losing to independents, and that the Democrats were losing at a faster rate. And that's part of, a national trend, that the party system is not holding the same sort of institutional sway that it used to, that people aren't signing up as a party the way their parents do it, that a lot of these independents tend to be younger, tend to be, you know, more millennial, tend to be people who are just, you know, see the two-party system as not an asset, but kind of a corrosive institution in American politics, and are not choosing either party.
What was in place that made Larry Hogan's election possible in 2014 that may not be there now? I answer my own question with one thing. He may face a stronger candidate than Anthony Brown presented in 2014 for the Democrats. That's one thing. But what else? I mean, the economic conditions are actually better now. He lowered highway tolls. That's something that people recognize, right?
Depending on whose team you play for, you have a different answer about why Larry Hogan won. And, you know, Larry Hogan's folks will say he won because he was a better candidate. So I just want to put that out there, as that's one of the mm-hmm. explanations.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Brown had Martin O'Malley's record tied to him.
He was a legacy
candidate. He was a legacy candidate, yeah. And he was unwilling to put distance between himself and Martin O'Malley. You know, it might have been something that voters wouldn't have bought, right? Like, how can you say, I was lieutenant governor when we passed all of these tax increases because we had to, and I supported them then, but now that I will be your governor, I'm not going to do that anymore. And actually, those were a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard thing to sell.
It is.
The same time, and this is something that Brown's campaign, you know, everybody likes to blame the media, but Brown's campaign will say privately that there was all of this polling out there, including our polling, that had Anthony Brown 9 points, 13 points ahead of Larry Hogan. And so you don't, why would people show up to vote for something that was going to be a landslide? Mm-hmm. And that was one of the factors that depressed, you know, voter turnout. I would argue, you know, that the media generally reflects what's happening instead of predicts or controls what's happening. And they had their own internal polling that showed Anthony Wren was not cracking 50%. That he was doing better than Larry Hogan in all of their polling, but that
for a Democrat, he was not cracking 50%.
Right, which was something that he needed to do.
Yeah.
So I guess there was, you know, that was kind of a candidate problem.
The other thing Hogan did that was impressive was change Maryland. He built a grassroots organization, or a grassroots organization was constructed that buoyed him along, and it certainly helped him in rural areas and suburban areas.
Yeah, and you know, some of the conditions in 2014 that may not exist in 2018 is that he was able to be a single message candidate. He was able to talk about pocketbook issues and just pocketbook issues and stay away from the sorts of, you know, third rail topics that would sink a Republican with a lot of Maryland Democratic voters. So for instance, the issues before him, he didn't have to talk about gun control because that was done. He didn't have to talk much about mass transit. Stuff was underway, and he said, we'll take a look at it. He didn't have to talk about women's rights. He didn't have to talk about abortion. He didn't have to talk about, you know, tax breaks. He didn't have to—
Immigrants.
Immigrants.
I don't think that came up very much. Certainly not the Dreamers.
Right.
Which will be an issue this year because of Trump's crackdown on them.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, fast forward 4 years later, he has still stayed away from a lot of those issues in Maryland, but the national mood and a lot of people in Maryland, I don't know if it's a proximity to Washington. I'm not quite sure why there's I'm from Colorado and I lived in Florida, and I've noticed here people are a lot more attuned to national politics in general.
Oh, yeah.
But particularly now. That there are a lot of people who, Democrats, who might say, I'm not going to vote for a Republican, just on philosophical grounds, right? And so the sorts of things that are in the air, the topics that are being talked about are, you know, immigration, the Dreamers, what are we going to do on health care? Are you going to be able to sustain
the Medicaid expansion?
Right, right.
I think the price tag on that is something like $2.7 billion the last time I saw it.
Yeah, and or even the Obamacare subsidies that President Trump canceled. I mean, the price tag on that's, you know, $95 million a year.
Right.
And in a budget where, you know, Maryland has like a $43 billion budget, but not all of that is money that Maryland has control over. You know, you can't control if federal government gives you billions for Medicaid, you spend it on Medicaid.
Or transportation,
mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't take money for the Purple Line and spend it on children's health insurance. So the actual pot of money that Maryland has available to it that a governor can look at and say, how do I want to spend this, is much smaller. It's more like $17, $18, $19 billion. And a lot of that is already spoken for because of the way that Maryland has been doing its budgeting. So the idea of carving $95 million out of that pot, it's just a huge sum of money.
Mm-hmm.
What is he going to do about that? What is he going to do about the children's health insurance program, which was something Hillary Clinton had advocated for under her husband's administration, that provides health care for all children who need it, and that, because of Congress, is set to expire. So there's all these kind of congressional actions or inactions that trickle down to the state.
Trump executive orders that affect the state.
Exactly.
That weren't in play in 2014. Donald Trump wasn't around in 2014.
Right.
As a factor.
I mean, and some of Hogan's advisors will say, okay, what can we actually do about it, though? Can we spend that sort of money?
Mm-hmm.
Can the state unilaterally pay for the Medicaid expansion? I mean, I would
be
hard-pressed to find a budget analyst who said that's possible. You know, by Larry Hogan saying that he doesn't like Trump's immigration policy, does that do anything besides aggravate a White House they're trying to work for? So, I mean,
whoever the Democratic candidate is will face the same issues, right?
Right, but they don't have the kind of boomerang effect where it might hurt their base, right? So that, like, a Democrat can say, like Brian Frosch, for instance, he can come out, you know, it feels like every week, maybe every other week, with a new legal action
against the Trump administration.
And there's no real downside for him, both politically or policy wise. There's no drawback. But Larry Hogan, if you look at Malia's polling from the Goucher poll a couple a couple weeks ago, you know, that there's a fair segment of Republicans who think he's put too much distance between him and Donald Trump. Does that mean that they would vote for a Democrat in 2018? No. But does that mean they might rather, like, stay home streaming Stranger Things instead of going out to vote? Maybe.
It's very interesting. Well, thank you very much, Aaron.
Oh, my pleasure.
Aaron Cox is the Baltimore Sun's State House Bureau Chief. You can find a link to her most recent stories on the developing campaign for governor and on the actions being taken by Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch in the notes with this podcast. A short break, and when we come back, we'll catch up with Heather Mazier.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Heather Mazier, the Liberal Democrat who unsuccessfully ran for the gubernatorial nomination in 2014, has a new project. Ms. Maryland, that's M-I-Z Maryland, Soul Force Politics. After retreating to her farm on the Eastern Shore for more than 2 years, Heather Mazier has reemerged with her new organization with a goal of bridging political divisions, a daunting task in the time of Donald Trump. The project involves a blog, a podcast, training camps for women interested in civic engagement, and helping people connect what's in their hearts to their activism. Yeah, it's interesting, Heather. We walked to my studio talking about Donald Trump and the latest travesties from the Trump administration. I guess we could spend this time talking about him. Trump is part of the reason why you're doing what you're doing, I think.
The rise of Donald Trump definitely brought Heather Mazier back into public action because I enjoyed a couple of years sitting on the sidelines after the governor's race, working on my farm, enjoying a semi-retired life. And then after the presidential election happened, realized that I needed to get off the sidelines again. There was still way too much work to be done. And all of the negative things that Trump's personality can and does represent, I believe in a world of contrasts. And to have that much darkness creates just as much light. I almost liken it to like pushing out all the zits of America, right? He's just popping zits everywhere and bringing things forward.
To the surface.
To the surface that allows those of us who would consider ourselves light workers to go in and start addressing.
Wow. I've heard every metaphor possible with regard to Trump. That's the first time I've heard zits, but that's good. It's fine. It works for me. You know, I was thinking about you. When you told me you had an announcement you wanted to make, I thought, oh, she's going to run against Andy Harris. Honest to God, that was my first reaction. I bet some other people might have thought that because you live in the first congressional district.
I do. We moved from Tacoma Park in Montgomery County, where we very much enjoyed living for many years, to our family farm that we had as a weekend place for a number of years in Chestertown. And we turned it into our permanent residence. It was too hard to manage the farm from afar. So we moved there full time in 2015.
Well, let me ask you this. You said you decided to not run again for anything. I mean, that you were quoted in Aaron Cox's story as saying that.
Well,
when did you decide that? And is that true?
Yes. Well, the question she asked me was I putting together Ms. Maryland Soul Force Politics as an entry point to running for office again? And I said, no, that's not what I'm doing here. I've had people ask me to run against Andy Harris. That's not a job I want. I'm not interested in serving in the House of Representatives, although I would like to see someone more in line with the way I think be in that seat.
Why aren't you interested in that? Why wouldn't you want to serve in Congress?
My sense of where Congress is right now is just a power play between which political party is going to be in control of the agenda, and they're not getting anything done, and they haven't for a very long time. It's part of the reason why I left working on Capitol Hill as a staff member and ran for the House of Delegates in Maryland to take my ideas to Annapolis, because I saw state legislatures as being the place where effective change was happening. I still see Congress as a place that mostly is getting nothing done but fighting and arguing, and that's not where I want to spend my time and talent.
Well, tell me how Ms. Maryland developed, how this idea developed.
Right after the election, and I went back to the farm. I was sitting on the back porch. And I was playing solitaire with a deck of cards, looking out on the creek on the back end. And there's eagles flying by and just the most serene picture imaginable. I've got this wood board laid over my rocking chair, and I'm playing old school solitaire with a deck of cards. And I start to think, oh my God, this is my life. I was so excited about it because I had spent 18 months running for governor. I had a team of 12 people deciding how I was spending every moment of my life. I had control of my own time and doing whatever I wanted for the first time. So I'm sitting there, oh my God, this is my life. And then 5 minutes would pass and I would say, this is my life? Oh my God, what am I doing? I'm wasting my time and talents. I'm sitting here playing solitaire.
I'm only how old? How old are you?
I'm 44 now.
I'm only 44. Wait a minute.
Yeah. And at the time, 42. Mm-hmm. And so there was a up and down. But then I found my rhythm on the farm and realized that I really needed that balance. After living a very external life, running for governor, going internally and just being connected to the land and farming and working with the chickens and the horse and all that, it was really restorative. And then the election happened in 2016. That forced many people off the sidelines because so much of what we care about seems to be threatened and at stake. But I didn't like what I was seeing as just the resistance. And I was especially troubled by the way in which the political divisions, which seem to have always existed, got exacerbated. And the division of us versus them in this country became almost intractable. And there's a real fatigue. People are tired of being at war with each other, but so much seems at stake that they don't know how to fight for what they believe in without being at odds and going for the jugular against the other, who's perceived as the other. And really, my approach to politics has always been a blending of bringing my deepest spiritual self into my civic actions. And I feel more free to talk about that now and propose it as a philosophical concept for how we engage with each other in these difficult times.
It's very interesting. It's like you can't run for office and talk about your spirituality. It wouldn't, and I don't mean religion. I mean where you are inside.
Yeah.
Like people think there's something weird about you if you do.
Yeah. And that's so bizarre that our culture has gotten to that place because we are all spiritual beings. And Soul Force Politics recognizes that. It's not about religion. I always like to clarify, we're not making any religious pronouncements. We're not talking about any tenets of faith. We're talking about the acknowledgement that we all have a conscience and that there is consciousness all around us that guides our decisions, that little voice inside of you that talks to you all the time. And our highest self, that spiritual connection to all that is, really wants us to go towards the place of being connected to each other. But right now, many of our actions are about dividing us up. And I want to try to foster dialogues, policies, training opportunities that help people rise to their best self.
So is the idea to get to people who may aspire to public office, to get them thinking this way? Or is it for everybody?
It's for everyone. I don't want to get into a place where people think I'm just trying to influence the influencers and encourage a certain type of people to run for office. This is about changing the culture everywhere. And when we change ourselves, that's when the politicians change. They're just a reflection of ourselves, our community, who we are collectively. Donald Trump doesn't exist in a vacuum. Donald Trump exists because he reflects a part of our community that has the same feelings and values and language that he uses that exists. It's not just him. He's a representation of the fact that that exists in our culture. And so when we come together as communities of people within families, within communities, putting aside ideological divides, political partisanship, really getting back at understanding how to dialogue and talk to each other again from a place of connection to our hearts, getting out of our heads and going back into our hearts.
Did you see Donald Trump coming and what he represents?
I didn't see it winning. It didn't surprise me that he was gaining traction and that he was a voice for people, thoughts, and ideas that had been pushed below ground for a long time. I wasn't expecting it to win, and ultimately we saw that the other candidate had almost 4 million more votes. So I wasn't wrong from my perception that it wasn't the majority beliefs. It did catch me off guard that he was able to pull together the strategic map to win the Electoral College.
But that thing he represents, I've been trying to put my finger on this ever since last year myself. Maybe I don't spend enough time in flyover country or in red states. Maybe here in Maryland we're just isolated from what goes on in the rest of the country, or even in Western Maryland or the Eastern Shore, where people hold these strong opinions about Barack Obama, for instance, and mm-hmm. the Affordable Care Act, and which way the country's going, and the culture wars, and abortion. Maybe we're just out of touch with all of that. It seems like all of that boiled up to the surface, and Trump was pushing buttons.
He's a master communicator, and he understands consciousness. He just unfortunately uses it to bring about our basis self rather than our highest self. And that's okay in its own way. It's serving a purpose that I mentioned earlier. It's bringing these things forward. We won't ultimately be able to heal what is the very real division and denial about systemic racism in our institutions in this country without the presence of someone pushing all of this up to the surface. This is giving us an opportunity. It's just a question of what we do with the opportunity.
It is a question of that, but the country just seems so divided now, divided in such an ugly way.
Yes, and I'm sure no more divided than we were when we took up arms and were at war. I mean, we have a history.
Well, that's a pretty bad extreme. You're talking about the Civil War?
Of course.
Yeah, well.
I'm just saying it's not unprecedented that we've gone through periods of time where there's deep division. But I do think we know how to navigate it differently now. But we're trying to navigate it with new tools that also have been changing the rules of engagement, social media. It's a beautiful way to connect us, and it's a way to find your tribe, if you will. But it also is a little bit of a license to pop off at the mouth and say and do things without thinking about the impact of them. And I like to remind people how powerful we are and how powerful our words are. One of my favorite spiritual authors, Marianne Williamson, reminds us that our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our greatest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. That's gotten attributed to Nelson Mandela and Maya Angelou and others in the past who've used the quote, but it's Marianne Williamson. And part of our power are our words. And when we are willing to take ownership of that power and be more thoughtful about how our words and our thoughts are designing our day, impacting our emotions, affecting how we interact with each other, and are putting an energy out into the world of either love or fear, then we become more responsible for how we shepherd those words and the impact that they can have on others.
Who do you think is going to be interested in Ms. Maryland?
Well, so far, a broad spectrum of people. We're offering everything from a policy blog that also includes things like Heather's 5 favorite farm fresh egg recipes. And I write about the hens on my farm and what it's like to have a flock. In that policy blog, one of the first things I write about is a new program I'm proposing called Benefit Maryland. If we're going to start talking about tuition-free benefits at community colleges or other higher educational institutions, let's have a carrot and stick approach where it's not just a benefit that we offer, but we're expecting something in return, and create a state-based service program modeled on the National AmeriCorps program that would also then help us compete for and bring in even more federal monies for our existing AmeriCorps programs in the state because of our state investment in a
okay.
bigger program.
Okay, that's an interesting idea. But who's going to be interested in that? Who's going to be interested in the things that you were just talking about, though? Dialogue, opening up, trying to get simpatico or empathy for the other side.
I'm going to turn the question back to you because I very much am in the middle of a lot of people praising me and saying, oh, this is such a breath of fresh air. I'm really excited about this. Maybe I'm just receiving a lot of that feedback.
Liberals. You've heard from some conservatives who say, I'd be interested in that. Did Andy Harris contact you? You know, here we are in such a polarized state in America, and a lot of people like it that way. They like the culture wars. Look at this guy, Steve Bannon. I mean, maybe he's an extreme. Maybe I'm just skipping over the people who are in the middle. But I'm thinking of the people who write me hate mail. You know, are they going to be interested in dialogue with me about what to do about assault rifles, for instance?
Yes, they are. I'm going to give you one example. This morning, I was on a conservative radio show, and I got a Facebook message from someone who said, and I'm reading from it right now, "My politics and overall view of the world likely could not be more different than yours, but it was refreshing to hear a progressive speaking in non-hateful, non-incendiary terms. That's not usually the case. I enjoyed your segment very much."
Oh, for God's sake. See, I'm going to stop right there. These progressives not speaking in hateful terms. I mean, who's cornered the market for hate speech and hateful terms when it comes to political discourse in this country? It is the right. And I will say that, and I will defend people on the left who, you know, put forward things like higher minimum wage and Obamacare, and then take all this crap, if you don't mind me saying, from the other side. And that's what I hear. I hear vitriol. I hear anger coming mostly from very conservative people. I hear racism coming from those people. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you communicate with them. I'm talking about Trump's base, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
I appreciate the passion that you just displayed. And my own personal opinion doesn't veer far off from it. Of course, we hear negative and vitriolic things from the other side as well. Take a deep breath when you feel that energy come in.
Okay.
Right?
Yes. And I'm not laughing. I am not laughing at you.
All I'm saying is all of us on both sides need to take the 1, 2, 3 pause before we allow someone else's words to then incite our own energetic response back to it, hold it, and then say, okay, I'm really glad that there's a door open right now for me to have a communication with you. And while our door has been opened, can you also acknowledge that, and I'm having this as a fake conversation with that person.
Hypothetical.
The hypothetical with the person that you just got exercised about. Mm-hmm. Can you acknowledge that your side also uses language that incites? And what way can we go about having a conversation about these things that doesn't go to that emotional triggering place? In my third episode, I interview Larry Hogan, and we spend an hour talking, some of it about things we agree on and some of it about areas where we disagree. Now, granted, I noticed that the conversation got more tense when we were talking about the things that we disagreed on, and my time was being stepped on a little bit more, and it wasn't the same beautiful flow.
Right. It became a little more combative,
maybe. A little bit, but still respectful. I will definitely give the governor great credit for the fact that we allowed our interest in trying to find some common ground to drive the conversation, even if we were each excited about trying to get the other to understand the perspective that we were coming from.
It's a lot to get over.
It is.
I mean, the rhetoric that's 25 years of Rush Limbaugh that has infested the country with this sarcastic, snarky rhetoric about anything that comes close to being a progressive idea in America. Mm-hmm. Personal attacks of people in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, I'll concede that some of it has been coming from the left, especially since Trump came on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. The resistance has become really angry and has used some of the same rhetoric that the right has used over the years.
And if we
Just seems so out of balance to me, though, Heather. You know.
Yeah, but we don't balance it out by replicating it. We don't balance it out by taking on the same darkness. Then they've won.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you have to take the high road.
You do.
It's a hard thing for progressives to remember when the crap is being thrown by Trump and others. Yeah,
it's a hard thing to remember when we're in our head, but I believe that progressives in particular are well situated to be jiu-jitsu masters in this regard, because so much of what drives their interest in policy issues is their heart connection to the change they're wanting to create. And so if you truly are able to shift into a place of your heart and your inner core strength of being able to hold space for someone's transformation. When you're holding space for someone's transformation, it's giving them the grace to say something that might set your triggers off, but not allowing that trigger to flare, because that's how you're going to get into a place of finding common connection. Because if you're both just triggering each other off, then you're spiraling and no one's listening to each other. And so some of these tactics are some of the things that will be taught in retreats and training camps that we eventually want to build. One of the initial offerings are 9 statewide workshops around the state on women's empowerment. I take, it's called Discovering Your Inner Wonder Woman. I have a multimedia interactive presentation based on the new hit movie of Wonder Woman. It's like, why did so many women come out of the theater feeling so empowered and strong and energized about that movie? I take the archetype of the successful warrior woman and break it down into what is it about the woman behind the shield, the internal issues? What is it about the woman wielding the sword? How to bring that into the external? How to use our lasso of truth to connect to speaking truth to power and speaking truth even when it's uncomfortable? And I walk through all these things that help women walk in their everyday life in a more empowered way. I also think this is a great opportunity to clarify that while my organization is called Ms. Maryland, M-I-Z Maryland, it's a little bit of a play on my last
name.
On
your last name, yeah.
But also on a feminine approach to leadership. This is not a women's organization, even though our first set of trainings are focused on women or men who are in touch with their feminine side. I'm not saying that men can't come to this training as well. It's really about giving people outlets for connecting to their best self, taking their power back, understanding the power we all wield. So much of what I witness that is going on around us is people spinning off in ways that like they're feeling out of control with everything that's going on around them. And we actually are in control and contribute to and impact way more than we give ourselves credit for. And by reconnecting to that spiritual power we have and then bringing that approach into our civic actions is when we start to shift how we interact in the world. And that's the ripple effect that changes and makes catalytic change possible.
Change involves changing minds, changing opinions, changing people's minds.
Or opening hearts.
Okay. Then do this for me. I'm just going to hand you something. I'd like you to talk about it in terms of the Ms. Maryland way, how you would handle this particular issue. No Republican voted for the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have tried desperately to destroy it. The president is out to destroy it. A program that provides health insurance for people who never had it before, who couldn't afford it before, low-income people and people just above poverty level. Seems like a good idea. Seems like we ought to be looking out for our fellow citizens that way. If government does anything with its money, it ought to be that. Seems like a reasonable thing, but no one from that side will ever say, will ever support it. Stand on that bridge for me, would you? How you have to build that bridge.
I'm not suggesting that people need to shift their opinions about the issues they care about. I am every bit the flaming progressive liberal who is always going to be out there saying, we need to bring back the millionaire's tax and provide middle class tax cuts and get corporate taxes right to give small business tax relief. Whatever the issue, legalize marijuana, pay for universal pre-K, be for universal health care. It's not about changing what we think is the right policy. It's just about changing the ways in which we're willing to talk about that. The training camps that where we want to bring people to the farm, they aren't necessarily about bringing up a particular issue. Mm-hmm. It's about bringing different ideological backgrounds together to go back to the basics of how can we just start to dialogue and not treat each other as the demon
anymore. You're at the first step. You're at the threshold.
Exactly.
How you open the door.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, within that door being open, I would talk to someone who thinks of Obamacare as being a negative thing. I would ask them, can you help me understand why you think it's so bad? and really engage them in a dialogue. Like, take all of the same positions that you have on why it's good, why it's necessary, people you know who benefited from it, what your own approach is. For example, I'm someone that supports it, but I also see that it's a market-based system that has its own failings. And, you know, my premiums have skyrocketed too. I mean, the problem is, what has happened is the people who have had to pay higher premiums, it's not because of Obamacare. That's the trend we were seeing anyway. The premium would be even higher if Obamacare wasn't in place. But it didn't take care of that problem for everyone, in part because it was a market-based solution. That was the compromise. There wasn't a single-payer structure that was put into place. It wasn't a program that would actually go in and create a health care system. We still have a sick care system that is grossly inadequate. So I can find commonality with someone on the other side to say, I agree with you, this isn't great. And so rather than talking about not having health care for people, what can we do to fix the existing program?
Yeah, because I bet if you talk to 10 people who would start out saying they opposed Obamacare, right? They probably maybe didn't like President Obama. But if you spent time with them, talked to them, I bet you would find that they agree that all Americans should have health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? As a fundamental starting point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's like when there were people, when the law was being passed, that were at town hall meetings, you know, that said, get your government hands off of my Medicare.
Yeah.
Without really stopping to realize that that's a government-based program.
Yeah.
So many people in our country already have a government-funded healthcare program, whether they are veterans, senior citizens, people in nursing homes or low-income families, the child health insurance program. The government actually has a very good record at providing high-quality, affordable health care and keeping the cost down while not impacting quality. But we've allowed the notion of government-run health care to become a boogeyman. And so the so-called fix, the compromise, was this market-based solution where we're still trying to allow for third-party insurers and profit margins to fix the problem with some government subsidies, and it's not working. And so I can cede to the other side that this isn't working and it needs to be fixed. But I'm asking you to come my way and saying that blowing it up and having nothing isn't the answer either, and that we have to come to a solution that works for all of us here.
So explain one more time for those like me who think Ms. Maryland is about developing political strategies or developing future leaders of America. Empowering women is one part of it, but not mm-hmm. necessarily for public office, right?
No, not necessarily, though sure, run for office if that's what's inspiring you.
Yeah, okay.
Blending politics and spirituality usually comes with a warning label, and we really need to rethink that, because our spirit connects us, it empowers us, it brings forward the passions of our heart. And our political discourse desperately needs the guidance, strength, and clarity of our soul's force for good in the world. And so our internal wisdom combined with our external actions is what yields soul force politics. And we have masters before us: Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Harriet Tubman, Nelson Mandela. They all brought the strength of their soul's force for good in the world to inspire a movement of people to act in that way, in how they brought forth the things they cared about in a way that created connections and not division.
Well, good luck with it, Heather.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I want to come over and visit your studio.
You need to. It's really awesome.
It looks really cool.
Well, we're right in the middle of my farm, and whereas you've got nice padded walls here in the middle of a city office.
This is foam from Poptronic's House of Foam in Baltimore.
nice little commercial there.
Yeah, but you have it looks like a cabin next to a pond or a pool of some kind.
Yeah, yeah. And so I do compete with sounds, but mine aren't sirens and ambulances. Right. My sounds I have to compete against are bullfrogs and guinea hens and the sounds of nature. So.
Well, I'd like to come visit.
I would love to have you on the show.
Good luck, Heather.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you. You can find links to Aaron Cox's recent story about Heather Mazier and to the Ms. Maryland Soul Force Politics website in the notes with our podcast. Heather Mazzier's recent podcast guests include Maryland Governor Larry Hogan and former U.S. Senator Barbara Mikulski. That's our show for now. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.